Welcome to Da Vinci's Discourse, where the minds of today's most innovative entrepreneurs are unveiled and explored. And my name is Kyle Campbell, your guide on this journey into the depths of the entrepreneurial psyche. So sit back, relax, and get ready to dive into the minds of the greats. This is Da Vinci's Discourse.
Mr. Colin Campbell, dude, awesome to have you here, man. A fellow Campbell from the clan. So, my friend.
There he is.
Yeah, there we go, man. So if somebody were to ask you, who are you? What would you say to them?
I'm a serial tech entrepreneur. I've been a serial tech entrepreneur for 30 years. I've had a lot of successes, a couple publicly traded companies, and I've had a lot of failures. It's been a roller coaster over the last 30 years. And about 10 years ago, I was asked to speak at MIT on the topic of how I was able to start, scale, exit, and repeat that over and over again. And I spoke to a group of about 60 successful entrepreneurs. And really, we began to see a number of patterns that existed within those companies that we had started. And it was really all about the story, the people, the money, and the systems, and how it changed between start, scale, exit, repeat. And then I would add that was the beginning or the genesis of the book, Start, Scale, Exit, Repeat, which we launched on October 3rd. And so now I guess I can say I'm also a number one best-selling author on Amazon as well.
Right on.
Number one in 13 categories on Amazon. So we're having a lot of fun with this. And it was a big project. It did take 10 years to write. And but you know what? In the end, it seems like people are really enjoying it.
Well, no kidding, man. Yeah, you can tell by the reviews too. So what are some of the things that you're up to nowadays? What's your passion? What's the new mission?
Yeah, so I continue to operate companies. I'm involved in about 20 companies. I'm principal shareholder of 10 companies. A couple of them I'll share here. One of them is paw.com, paw.com, which is an e-commerce company that I would sort of call it the Wayfair of pet products. We do memory foam pet rugs, car seats, waterproof blankets. And that company's actually been on the Inc. 5000 for 3 years as one of the fastest growing companies in the United States. So that's an e-commerce company. And then flip over to real estate. We have 19 properties in South Florida. We do vacation rentals.
Nice.
So like totally different. And then flip over to an AI company that I just recently invested in. It's called Pensilla. And it's basically the $99 a month marketing team. It's your AI marketing team for $99 a month. I also am involved in a company called Geeks for Less, where we have 800 people in the Ukraine who are coders. That's been a sort of a challenging environment over the last 3 years. But we're actually holding steady and doing pretty well despite the atrocities that are occurring there in Ukraine. I've got a number of other very interesting companies, but
yeah, you're a serial entrepreneur, baby. You got all kinds of them, dude. I love the AI marketing perspective of it. I'm wondering, how do you use your AI marketing? Like, you recently invested in this company, I reckon. How are you using AI in your marketing for the rest of these companies? Are you kind of morphing what you invested in there and spreading it to some of the other ones? For example,
yeah, I mean, Pensilla is very early on. It's in the early sort of beta mode right now. And it's actually a company that my nephew started, and then he obviously wanted help scaling it. And what's interesting in the book, we talk about in the third chapter, catching the wave. And I don't know how connected you are with technology and technology authors, but there was an author by the name of Jeffrey Moore who wrote Crossing the Chasm and Inside the Tornado. And we had the opportunity to interview him for the book, and it was just phenomenal, the information that we got from him. But we had been living, I talked about those patterns earlier. We had been living in a lot of these companies in a pattern of catching a wave. And in the early 1990s, it was a dial-up internet. It became the largest ISP in Canada. 2000s, it was hosting and web hosting and email. And we became the largest provider in that space, sold to telecoms. Both those companies were public companies and both were sold off. And what we noticed is that we began to identify these waves and invest in companies or start companies just before the waves are going to take off. So we try to get a sense for that. And in the book, we talk about a lot of ways you can identify potential waves. And then with the help of Geoffrey Moore, we talk about when you do hit a wave that's really huge, how do you capitalize on it? What are the secret formulas to capitalize on that? And in today's market with AI, we're talking about one of the greatest paradigm shifts in the history of our lifetime. I mean, it is bigger than anything else we've ever seen, bigger than the internet itself. AI will mint more millionaires than any other tech shift in history. That's what we're talking about here. So how do we win in a marketplace like that? And that is something that we talk about in the book. We actually get into some of those, but I'll share a few of them with right now with you if you like. When you're in a tornado, it's absolutely important to focus like a laser beam. Now, Geoffrey Moore talks about the bowling pin analogy. When you're in a chasm, you want to try to win over one bowling pin and then knock another one down, another one, another one, until you become the largest provider. Well, when you're in a tornado, it's also important to focus on the laser beam focus, because you want to be the best in the world at it. And you've got a lot of competition. So in the case of Pensela, when it first launched, the CEO was thinking about making the product available for all businesses until we had this conversation, and he realized, I can't compete with Canva, right? So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to say, okay, how can I be better and the best in the world at one particular thing? And that's by being the best in the world at e-commerce companies. And we had a number of e-commerce companies in our portfolio, so we decided to, or he decided to build the technology for those e-commerce companies. He really understood them. Build the APIs into Klaviyo and Shopify, and make that product the best in the world, so that everybody can identify it as being the best in the world, or the best solution in the world as well. The next thing to think about in a tornado is that how do we make it easy? Okay, because the vast majority of people in the world are technological. They have a phobia of technology, believe it or not. And in the book, we show Geoffrey Moore's technology adoption curve. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Kyle, his adoption curve, where we have
I
the
think so.
innovators, and then you have a chasm,
Right.
and then you have the early majority, right? Exactly. So when you first come to market, you've got these innovators, and I'll call them geeks, whatever you want to call them. They're enthusiasts. They're people who, a little bit like myself, I got the first Model X, number 984, and I still have it today. But
No
in reality,
shit.
I was always trying to, like, it's one of the tricks in the book too, is live in the future. Is always trying to live in the technology of the future, whether it's the fastest internet, the best AI. Like, always, I bought every AI possible membership I can buy out there. I'm playing with all of them. I'm trying to live in the future. I'm trying to understand what that future is going to bring us and try to visualize so I can position for the wave. But one of the things that you really need to focus on if you want to win in a tornado is make the product easy, because we're talking about the early majority. The early majority are pragmatists. They're a lot more pragmatists in the world than there are innovators. So innovators might get you started, get you out of the gate, but you're going to want to focus a lot on your GUI, on how to make the product simple, not as complicated, so that the majority population, especially the early majority, can really grab on to that technology. The last thing I will say, and this was inspired by Geoffrey Moore again, is that when it comes to winning in a tornado, whoever delivers the fastest wins. Okay? Whoever delivers the fastest wins. Now, you're too young to remember the 90s, but back in the 90s, there was a company called CompuServe. And CompuServe, again, was really geeky. It was designed for the innovators. And then there's another company that came out called AOL, and they made the product easy and simple. But what they also did is they distributed diskettes everywhere, diskettes and CD-ROMs later, everywhere in every magazine. And it was so pervasive in our office, we used to use the CD-ROMs as coasters, because you just get so many of them. And they had massively focused on distribution, and they won that game, and they became much larger than CompuServe. We see this happen over and over again in every industry where you can have something great. If you build it, they won't necessarily come, right? But how do you build something great and then distribute it? And distribution is your key. Speed to market is your key. You don't need to be perfect. So I know I'm sort of rambling here, but I am excited about AI. I'm very excited about how to win in a tornado, like an AI tornado. So.
What comes to mind when you say that, man, is the simplicity of a Mac, for example. When, like, back in, let's say, 84 with the Apple II, the Mac was like the, okay, so you get the Windows that was adopted later and that was widely adopted, but the Mac has always been simpler than the Windows machine, right? It's like it's very intuitive, it's easy to use and tap into. Are you a Mac guy or a Windows guy?
I'm a Mac right now, but I was a Windows. But you know, Windows was a copy of Mac,
Right,
right?
exactly.
Right.
Yeah,
So
no
exactly.
shit.
So they recognized early on that they were getting too complicated, and they had to simplify it. And you're dealing with a couple of other
That's the same
issues there.
thing.
Windows or DOS, MS-DOS at the time had standardized. A lot of the computers are standardized, and believe it or not, there was a tornado there before or essentially as the Mac came out. But the Mac said they wanted to be proprietary, and then IBM said, "We'll open this up to everyone." And MS-DOS was opened up and whatnot. So you had hundreds of companies competing against one company. Again, distribution. When you're in a tornado, whoever distributes the fastest wins. They became the standard, and it took many, many years before Mac, you know, finally. I think Mac's probably pretty close by now. I don't know if but they definitely have a substantial market share today versus where they were many years ago.
Yeah, no shit. Well, I think it's less than, I think it's still like less than 10% though, which is funny because I think that might be the global number. Because if you go to a
Yeah.
Starbucks, you never see somebody pull out a Windows machine, very rarely when everybody's got a Mac. But I think it's still less than 10%. So, what are some of the lessons that we can kind of glean from that technological wave, for example? And then we can move into the internet era too, if you want to. And I'm looking for patterns that you've identified over the years that are now going to be repeating themselves in your estimation with the AI market, so that we can go about positioning ourselves with the future based on what's happened in the past. We don't know if that's going to be an accurate predictor or not, but we can, it's all we got. So, what are some of the
Right.
things we can glean from it?
Well, it's interesting because it's almost like the Big Bang Theory. You know, when you're early on in an industry, very early on, you know, a tiny little bit of effort or wins can actually lead to huge gains down the road. And you can see how, you know, IBM computers, as you're pointing out, are still dominating the world many, many years later, even though, you know, Macintosh has done so well. But you know, so that's one lesson to learn from it. So we really want to focus our energy, our resources, our money. What we want to do as we enter a tornado like AI, and we talk about this extensively throughout the book, is how to scale your business. And scaling, there are a lot of different things we need to think about. I'm going to come back to the four things: story, people, money, and systems. Believe it or not, 82% of startups fail because they do not have the right funding. All right. So let's take that off the table. If we have a concept, we have an idea, and we want to scale that idea, we want to prove it. In order to prove it, we need to get the funding for that company. And that's something we need to think about in the concept of tens or 10 times. So I call it adding zeros or scaling in zeros and having a mindset of scaling in zeros. When we want to scale our company, we're going to want to envision a company that's 10 times the size, that's got, so what kind of people would we need? Let's set up an organizational chart of a company that's 10 times the size. Okay. Let's identify who those positions are. Let's identify the personality profiles that we want for those people. And then let's begin to plug them in and hire people. Which Jack Welch calls hire people with a runway. So if you're doing $1 million in sales and you want to do 10 million, you're going to want to hire people with runway. So a key ingredient here is people and figuring that component out. Another ingredient is the story. And I think one of the coolest chapters in the book is the one that talks about X factor. And X factor is something unique and different that you have that no one else has. And it reminds me of a story that we talk about in the book by a gentleman by the name of Joe Foster. Joe Foster was the founder of Reebok. And in 1979, he actually had only $9 million in revenue. And then it wasn't until he won 3 5-star reviews in Runner's World that one of his employees identified an opportunity to go into a space called aerobics. See, none of the shoe companies were in that space. So they decided to go what Joe Foster calls into the white space, into a place that no one's operating at. See where I'm coming at here, okay? And they went into that space and they caught their big break. Jane Fonda wore the shoes. And in 4 years, it went from 9 million to 900 million. It's actually larger than Nike. It was 1986 was the largest shoe company in the world. And they've fallen back since, they're only worth a few billion today. But it just demonstrates the importance of going into the white space. At Paw.com, that dog products company, we invented memory foam dog rugs. We invented waterproof blankets. When I say invented, we pioneered these categories. We pioneered the memory foam car seat, single, dual, and triple car seats for the back of your. We pioneered these three major categories. We decided to go into nutraceuticals for dogs, and we have almost 1 million customers. And we're like, okay, let's go to this. Like, all we need is 1% of our customers. Da da da. It'll be a great business. We sold 37 subscriptions, and I was one of them. We decided to go into shampoos, and mind you, we're an e-commerce company, and at the time they didn't really think about what about shipping and all. But we went into shampoos. We literally have a 100-year supply of shampoo. If you want
No.
shampoo, it's a really good deal. But we just liquidated. We finally liquidated it. When we went into the white space, when we identify errors or bottlenecks in the market that no one else is addressing, we can win in the marketplace. And we've seen that happen. And National Car Rental just show up at the lot and go to the car and leave. Domino's Pizza, 30 minutes or free. They reinvented a bot. They identified a bottleneck that people get hungry, they want food fast. So we're going to solve that bottleneck. They re-engineered their entire organization to make certain that they could deliver 30 minutes or free. And not only that, they put what I call in the book a nearly unbearable brand promise. All right.
Nearly unbearable
Nearly
for the
unbearable
brand.
brand promise. Exactly. And by doing that 30 minutes of free, they won. So back in 2006, I mentioned we had a web hosting and email company. We sold to telecoms. And the day before we were trying to close a huge contract, it was like a $10 million contract over 10 years. And we got notice that we were going to lose the deal. So my CTO and I, we got on a plane, we flew to Atlanta. We met with Earthlink was the company. We met with the middle executive there at Earthlink. He said, okay, let's go to lunch. He only had a two-seater car. So my CTO sat in the front, and I it was actually one of the first electric cars called a Wego. And I sat in the trunk of this little Wego going to the another, that's another lesson. Do whatever it takes to get the deal. We show up at the restaurant and we say, okay. Because we knew that his number one concern was that if a migration occurs, he could lose his job. That's what middle-level executives hate migrations more than anything else because they can lose their job. So he says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you a 100% migration guarantee. And we're talking about 80,000 websites and 1 million email addresses, a 100% guarantee. And for every website you lose, we're going to pay you fair market value, whatever fair market value is. And this was a huge commitment. We won that deal. We re-engineered the operations and completely re-engineered our operations. We had 200 people in Ukraine working on heuristics and migrations. We became the best in the world at migrations. And then we won AT&T, Vodafone, British Telecom. We won every single major contract because we had figured out our X factor.
Figured out the white
Domino's
space.
X factor. And so that's the part of the scale of the story. So what is your X factor in an AI world? Right? And how can you be different? What unique problem are you solving that somebody else isn't solving? Are you just trying to copy someone else? Because that generally I find that doesn't work. What is the bottleneck you're trying to solve?
Hey, I hope you're enjoying the podcast, and I want to let you know that I've got a free book that you can get if you want to tap into more of these resources, and you can get that for free at kylesbook.com. Back to the podcast.
And that's where you can get scale. That's where you can win big if you can solve a particular bottleneck. And then when you've scaled it, it's time to exit and then repeat that all over again.
Yes, which is perfect for the creator of us. Entrepreneurs are always chasing shiny objects. So what the layout that you talk about is perfect for entrepreneurs, right? What I'm curious about is, how do you know what white space is going to take off? Because I could say, I built a shower product that involves putting an umbrella over you. It's like, sure, nobody else is doing it, but it's also not a viable business. So I mean, who the, it doesn't make any damn sense, but it's still different, right? So how do you know what white space to step into? How do you know that it's going to be successful?
Yeah, so we're going to want to think about a bottleneck again, or a need in the marketplace.
Yes.
There's a company in Texas. It was a bakery that made cookies, and they delivered the cookies, and like other bakeries in Texas. And what happens when the cookies got to the location, they tended to be cold. So they said, okay, how do we beat that? They registered a domain name called cookiedelivery.com. And then they decided to design a truck. So the truck would bake the cookies on the way to the customers. When they arrive, they're piping hot cookies. So, I mean, right there, that was just being that innovative, thinking like that. And I'll tell you this, at PAW, we fail at about 8 out of 10 products. So why is the company so successful? Because
2 out of 10, baby, you found a white space for them.
Right. We test and fail more.
Okay.
Scale winners quickly. We cut losers fast. Okay. Yeah. We test and fail more.
Okay.
We scale winners quickly. We cut losers fast. By doing that, we're able to identify the two winners. And so when I say test and fail more, we'll do 100 products. We all get together. We think this is the best thing since sliced bread. We have like 4 or 5 really cool products coming to market right now. We all think they're amazing. Let's just say one of them hits. We'll scale that to 1 million products, right? So when the one that hits, we scale the hell out of it. The ones that don't hit, we kill them fast. So and we do, of course, our best to get patents. Patents protect them. I have a whole chapter on defense and moats and registering for patents and distribution of the moat. And there's all the, you know, there's so many components to starting, scaling, exiting, repeating, and having it be successful at all occasions. But failure is part of the concept. Failure of a product, or even failure of your companies, they're the scars of our past that guide us through our new ventures. They really are. And as long as we can learn from that, we can build going forward.
The stars of the past that guide us to
stars
new adventures.
Of the past.
Yeah.
That's right. I got a lot of scars. I got a lot of scars.
Oh shit, man. I what I heard originally was stars in the past. And so I was thinking the
Oh, it's scars. It's scars.
It's scars too, scars. Baby. Yeah, for sure. But I'm thinking I like the stars analogy too, because what you're talking about is like stars in the infinite canvas of space. So let's say, so there's the stars, which are the failures, but you're still, there's the infinite space that surround the stars where there's the potential. We're talking about white space. Maybe this is more to flesh out there. Eh? Yeah. But going back to the white space, trying to find white space that you can build in, that there's nobody else in the market that's doing this one thing. That's what I mean by this analogy, is because the stars are what's already been done. They're the material in the infinite, and the space is what you're aiming for to build something in that nobody else has been able to build in there before. But certainly a lot of scars in the past, man, too. No doubt about that. It's that's a part of it. So what your theory is, and this is more than a theory, this is your practical action steps that have worked for you, is massive amount of testing, get that over with, not being emotionally attached to any result, but saying if this works, then we're going to scale the shit out of it. But we're not going to overinvest. We're not going to buy $1 million worth of shampoo without testing that the market wants it first, right? And maybe that's a sore spot for you. I don't know. That's a
No, right? I mean, like, the reality is egos get in the way.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes we think we know better than our employees or others.
Yeah,
But
sure.
no, we've changed the culture of PAW. We've made our mistakes. We have our scars, and now we tend to test and fail more, scale winners quickly, and cut losers fast. As part of scale it winners quickly, we have a formula now where we have a multi-distribution strategy, so that it used to be just Facebook marketing, and that was our main focus, and maybe Google marketing. Now, of course, we do Facebook, Google, but we also do QVC. We do companies like BarkBox. We do Good Morning America. We have a multi-tier distribution strategy. And once you've set up that distribution path, when you do launch a new company, a new product that's a hit, you can scale it very quickly.
Right.
Okay,
You've
so
got the relationships in
distribution,
place.
not underestimate how important distribution is, and is part of the model of scaling a business.
That presumes that the product is successful already. So let's say that we're still in the testing phase. How do you go about testing? So let's say you've got 10 products, which, I mean, an entrepreneur, okay, let's say, like I said, they've got ideas galore. So instead of saying, I think this is what the marketplace will like and buy, most importantly, you test all 10 of them. What's your testing process look like before you launch it on the QVC and then Morning America? How do you go about testing it to get the results immediately so you know which one to scale?
We're talking specifically here about e-commerce, but if you're in a subscription business, there would be different KPIs. With e-commerce, when we send it out, we send it to our existing customer base and see if there's demand. Okay, that's yes, there's demand. Good. Phase two, let's just put it on Facebook. Let's start marketing it. Let's check out what our ROAS, return on ad spend, is. If our return on ad spend is 3.5 or higher, let's scale to infinity, as long as we have the margins to do it, right? And then once that works, okay, now we have a hit. Let's push that into Petco or Wayfair or all the other distribution channels as well. So we have a model. We actually wrote it out to say, this is where we start, this is where we go. If you are in a subscription business, we're going to want to look at, and this is a little trickier with subscription because your cost of acquisition is a little higher, but you're going to want to look at what your cost of acquisition is versus your lifetime value of that customer. And as long as you're positive, you should be able to accelerate to infinity as long as you have the funding, because subscription businesses require funding. But they're the ones that venture capitalists like to back the most. So if you're in that kind of business model, you're going to want to look at that. And it's going to be tricky in the first 1,000 customers, first 100 customers, first 1,000, to get a model where you're acquiring at such low costs and your lifetime value is X. Now, as an example, with Pensilla, your AI marketing team, we've been under development now for 15 months. We work with multiple AI platforms. We know it's going to be challenging at the beginning. And this is just coming out now. This is like live. Like this is, but we're applying all of what we know about the tornado, right? What we talked about earlier, right? So we're testing different models and advertising campaigns, et cetera, et cetera. And we've also now connected with influencers who, are huge in the e-commerce industry, and we've cut affiliate deals with them to take this to the market to blow it up really quickly. Early, we've seen pretty good results, but that's because there's a tornado with unlimited demand. We know that, right? Everybody wants a low-cost way of managing their social media, their ads, that kind of stuff, all on a platform, and that's what Pensilla does.
Is it going to be to the point where it'll actually create the content and post it automatically, where we don't have to do any
It
manual
already does.
intervention whatsoever?
It already does that. And how it does that is it looks at your product pages on your website.
Okay.
So it's going to start with that. It can actually help you improve your product pages and your landing pages, but it'll start with your, but you could literally have it do that. And it'll come up with 25 different advertisements based on the time of year, themes, all that kind of stuff. And, maybe it's not 100%, but maybe it's 90%, so that somebody who goes in there can simply look it over and improve it or add to it or edit it. And then it'll automatically schedule based on all social media channels and advertisements.
I love that, man. That's what I'm looking forward to, is a totally autonomous. I don't want that. I don't want the 10% even. I want to just say, okay, here's my social media channels, upload some data, it scans your website, and then have it completely automated. I don't have to do a thing. It just automatically takes the content from a podcast, for example, and repurposes it without my having to do anything throughout all the channels. That's what I'm looking forward to. And that's the beginning of it, right? Neil Patel, what he told me was that he thinks the AI is overestimated for now, but underestimated in
I
time.
see. It's cool there. Well,
You're lagging out a little bit. What's up?
yeah. No, that's not. I was gonna add that this is what AI is doing, it is taking average people like me and producing phenomenal content, phenomenal productivity. I liken it to Tony Stark strapping on that suit and what he can achieve when he wears that suit, right? It's like you, I mean, I've literally written contracts with it. I've done board motions. I've done legal memos. I've done calculations. We've done marketing. We've done content writing. We've reduced our costs dramatically, legal and content at PA, and it's improved customer service. Someone who's in Philippines who may not have the perfect English doesn't matter anymore. As long as you've got good content, as long as you got a good understanding, you could write a freaking movie script if you want now. As long as you got some imagination, some, you know, that's even that. We have to go into the white space. I often say people don't use AI to write your business plan. In the book, we have a 4 sticky note business plan. You can do it in 30 minutes, but we want the power of the entrepreneurial mind. You can never outsource the entrepreneur. We don't want groupthink to come in. Now, that being said, once you've got your idea and you're solid, you can use AI to write that investor plan for you. They'll do the SWOT analysis, competitive analysis, the risk factors. They can do all of that kind of stuff and help you make a really fancy advanced plan that you can use. But I often say, we're not going to want to outsource the entrepreneur even with AI. You got to build the plan yourself because we want to think, we think differently. We don't think like the way that AI would think. They're thinking like the way the majority of the population would think.
Right. That's a good
We want to
point.
think differently, right?
At least
So,
pointed in the direction of thinking in this realm, but I like it. It's not going to replace the creative mind because I mean, okay, who knows, man? But right now, it's certainly not replacing the creative mind. That's for damn sure. When it came to finding the white space for paw.com, for example, let's say for the memory foam carpets, how did you know that? I mean, like, sure, we go about testing it, and like we talked about, but how did you know to come up with that idea? How did you come up with that idea originally, and
well, I
then
mean, we
to
were
start
inspired to
marketing to
do that
begin
because
with?
we had sort of traditional dog beds, you know, the bolster dog beds and whatnot. And they were doing okay. They were doing okay. But then we found there was just a lot of competition. And one thing we talked to our customers about is they were saying, look, we don't like them because they're ugly, generally. And could we fit them in the decor of the home? And I think that's really the, you know, the thesis of paw.com is that, you know, we want them to look great in the home, like a piece of art in the home. But at the same time, we want them to be comfortable for our dogs. And why can't we have memory foam in a rug for a dog that they could just lie on? And, you know, ideation, we came up with it, we tested it, it worked, and we scaled that. And we sold now almost 1 million rugs and blankets. Over 1 million. We sold well over 1 million. Yeah, rugs and blankets. And now car seats are taking off as well. So.
Freaking crazy, man. But what I'm trying to get out of you is the creative process that you undergo to find the white space to begin with, so that any other business owner, whether it be a consulting business or a Facebook ad agency, whatever, they'll be able to use your methodology for finding white space and then be able to tailor it to work for them in their business. So what's the
Yeah.
process look like for developing that
The
white
one thing
space?
we do is we do actually talk about this in the book as well. We do 2 days of strategic planning, 88 days of execution. So we have our team go offsite and we will ideate around products that we've seen. Now, a number of us are always looking out for it, right? We're always looking to say, you know, what's innovative? You know, what could actually work here? Does this make sense? You know, the other day I was in the pet store and we saw a piece of furniture for a cat that looked like a coffee table. I mean, so we're always trying to think about those types of products in line with who paw.com is, right? We're not a shampoo distributor. We're not a nutraceuticals. What we are is a pet furniture and design company making pet products look really cool in your home and also comfortable for your pet. And as long as we stay within our core mission, we tend to do pretty well. So we actually do have structured you know, meetings with our entire team, and we brainstorm all these products, and we're always aware. We're always looking for those opportunities that we can build on and be different. See, you don't always have to be completely different. You can be a little bit different, and that matters on Amazon. That matters on wherever you're going to be selling your products on.
So what's that brainstorming session look like? Let's say you're with your team, you're what is it, a whiteboard kind of a style? Everybody's just
Okay, so
unfiltered spewing it out, and then you analyze after.
So I do sometimes I've done different formats, but one of the ones I like the best is I break the team up into twos and say, okay, everybody's going to go for a walk. We're going to come back with five ideas. We all come back with our five ideas. I don't care how kooky they are, right? We love kooky. We love different. I came up with the idea 5 years ago of doing a shopping cart tote. So you bring your dog, you can put the shopping cart and put it up. And they all laughed at me, by the way, 5 years ago. We just launched that and it's a hit. It's going to QVC this month. All right. So there's an example of how a product like that could evolve. And in any case, we break up into twos, everybody goes on their way, we come back, we throw the idea, go around circles, we throw the ideas on the board, we all walk up and we put our check marks on our top three, and then we bubble up, here are the top four or five ideas. And this is sort of a consensus building way. Now, don't freak out if you're the type A entrepreneur who's an inventor who says, well, what the heck? I don't want to trust my team, right? Believe it or not, you'll be surprised at the results you get from it. And again, I'm not suggesting that there aren't Steve Jobs in the world out there, and there aren't, there's a lot of innovation that can happen. And by the way, this is a plebiscite. It's not a referendum, which means that it's optional. The leader will choose what they want to do in the end, but you're sort of getting a consensus. It's interesting on, that show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Yeah. What do you think's better? Is it the call for an expert lifeline, or is it the crowd? Who comes up with a better score?
Oh, the crowd every time. If it
Yeah,
is,
so you know the show. So it's like something
yeah.
61% are, call a lifeline, and 90% plus is the crowd. So there is power in, there is
That's a good
genius,
point.
the people around you. And when you try to tap that genius, you'll be surprised what you come up with. As long as you're able to recognize it. If you're all about, okay, this is my idea, and you're stuck on your ego and all that, da, 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 that's a dangerous formula. We really try to embrace the team and coming up with ideas. And it doesn't matter who comes up with the idea, as long as everybody's throwing ideas in there. And it's an environment where you feel comfortable doing that.
I like the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire analogy, man, because you think about it, and yeah, if you actually watch the show, that they're way more statistically likely to be correct as opposed to the one person that they call it, because you're tapping into the collective, and instead of counting on one person, maybe there's 100 people, and therefore the odds of, not exactly, but the odds go up 100 times. Now there are differences in knowledge, et cetera. That goes back to the leader as opposed to trusting their team, but you're saying that that consensus is important, and I agree with you. It just comes down to, well, what if my team doesn't have that creative ability, and that's why they're entrepreneurs as opposed to entrepreneurs. And I see where that lack of trust in them would come up. So you're saying just give it a try, see what happens, see what ideas they come up with, and it also builds that familial feeling within the organization too, because you're not only just dictating, telling them what to do. It kind of creates more of a democracy, which, as we've seen in politics, it's a more longer lasting system, to say the least. Hence the issues in Ukraine, et cetera.
I'm not certain I'd go as far as democracy. Like I said, it's really the entrepreneur. And again, now you need an entrepreneur that needs to identify, that's a good idea. Oh, that's a really good idea. That we should do something like that. Right. So,
And see how to develop it.
and it doesn't have to be what I said, because these were the top five products, we're going to launch those top five products. No, it's going to go through the entrepreneurial, that entrepreneur who has a sense of the market. The other thing I will say is every person on our team has a dog. We all love dogs. It's a passion. So if you can hire people who are passionate around your concept, your idea, it makes your business a lot better as well.
Yeah, and you mesh better, right? I love my dog, man. I don't know what I'd do without the little guy now. Okay, so let's wrap
Got a
this up
dog?
with,
Yeah.
he's a Chesapeake Bay Retriever, man. He's the best. I literally,
Oh,
I don't
wow.
know what I would do without him. Yeah, best friend in the world, man. We'll wrap this up with this. Can you give me a blueprint in terms of developing that, finding that white space step by step? What an entrepreneur who's watching, trying to differentiate themselves in the marketplace, can do to be able to find that white space and tap into the tornado effect, that ability to capture a market slice and don't let it go because you can be number one in it. How do they go about finding that?
So my son found a $20 bill once, and he said he was lucky. And I said, "No, you were observant." All right. So as entrepreneurs, as future entrepreneurs, we're going to want to be observant. We're going to want to be aware that when there we find a bottleneck, we find a problem that we can solve, that, oh, that is a problem we can monetize. That's something I could take that to other companies as well. You might be working for one company and you're implementing AI at one company and you're having a lot of success with it. Just take a step back and say, hey, what if I stepped out of this company and I became a consultant and I could implement this AI for 100 companies or 200 companies? That's what we're doing. We're trying to be observant. We're trying to be aware of what are the problems in the market? What are the bottlenecks in the marketplace? And when we're aware of those bottlenecks, that's when we can begin to act on them. And that is the key too, is that's the second chapter on the book, Ideas to Action. All right. So back in 2006, my friends and my business partners were all sitting in a dacha in Ukraine. That's a cottage, little thing or whatever in Ukraine. And it's one of our development centers. And we came up with this idea called My Yellow Button. And you press the yellow button on the phone because here's the issue. In our prior company, we're traveling all over the world. We can't get a freaking taxi anywhere. So why don't we come up with an app? And we had an app company at the time developing apps that has a yellow button. You press it and you can see the car coming towards you. So we even registered the domain name. But then on Monday, the app company, nothing happened. They kept building the games. When not 2 years later, 3 years later, Uber launches, Lyft launches, and you can see the effect after that. Don't be one of those entrepreneurs or one of those people that sit back and have these great ideas, but never act on them. You're going to want to start taking small steps, start acting on those ideas. We call it ideas to action. What are the things you can do right now? Getting the domain name, going to the trademark database, making certain you search for that name, putting a logo to it, vetting your idea with your friends and family, not the yay-sayers or the naysayers, but people are your peers that you can truly vet the idea through, because you can sometimes vet it with them and you can make the idea better and better and better. And then we're going to want to test and fail more, scale winners quickly and launch, scale winners quickly and cut those losers fast.
When you look at it from the test mindset, I get it because it's you're like you've got the ability to test and see what fails, right? See, that's the problem is how do you know what idea to latch on to? Because we've got ideas all the freaking time. It's like you see, we are observant of problems as entrepreneurs. It comes down to we can't do all of them. How do you know which one to focus on to put your energy into? What's your answer to that? Because like I said, ideas,
Well, I mean, it
opportunities
goes as far as
everywhere,
this.
especially
Sometimes
now.
I've seen this used is that someone will actually have a product idea. They'll go and they'll build a nice advertisements video, whatever. They'll post it on Facebook and they'll see how many orders they can get and what their ROAS is, even without having any product.
Yeah, I
If
love
it
that.
goes, just refund all the credit cards, say, oh, we apologize, but the product won't be ready till whatever. And then if it doesn't go, then don't take it any further. So you're not investing a lot. But I think that's going a little too far. I think you can invest a little bit of money, get some prototypes out there, actually have some products and user-generated content and that kind of stuff that you can use to market and test it. Sometimes you have to give your idea a little bit of time. The CEO of Paul right now has been saying, I think we've been killing products too fast now. We might have gone from the pendulum of going too slow. Going too fast now, killing products too fast because they didn't sell in this market, but they sold really well on QVC. So what's not, so it really depends. Yeah.
It's hard, man, because you never know what's going to take off or not. It comes down to the testing at the end of the day. So, brother, dude, I think we walked through a lot of the process in terms of finding that white space and being able to step into it, as opposed to hoping, guessing, praying one day, maybe someday it's going to work out. You're identifying a ripple in the marketplace, a wave, and riding that puppy till the heyday. And hopefully it's the right one. If not, kill it and start again. But you've given us the process today, man. So yeah, thank you. What else do you have to add before we kick this off here?
Yeah, and what's old again is new again, right? With Joe Foster from Reebok, and it's
Right.
just I've gotten to know him fairly well. We're friends now, and his story of going from 9 million to 900 million by going into aerobics, doing something that no one else does, is incredible, and that was in 1979.
It's like
the
Chip
story of
Wilson
what
with
was needed,
Lululemon.
how important reviews were, how important an influencer was, you know, Jane Fonda wearing the shoes. What's old again is new again. And it's interesting that a lot of the theories that we have in the book, Start, Scale, Exit, Repeat, here in this book, a lot of the theories come from my experiences, but also from over 200 interviews. We interviewed 200 people, including Joe Foster, Jeffrey Moore, and Vern Harnish, and so many others who were experts in the space. 50 of the interviews made the book. By the way, the book is designed for the ADHD entrepreneur. It has
Perfect.
57 chapters. 57 chapters. It's color coded. The whole book is color coded. We
Nice.
have 30 illustrations, 180 callouts, and it really is broken down in such a way as to make it simple to read. It's actually a really fun physical. We made having a physical book fun again, and it's meaty. I admit it's meaty. It's when we published with Forbes, Forbes came to me and said, "You do realize your book is twice the size of any of our other books." Well, you know what? I couldn't. I just tried to cut it back. I just couldn't cut it back. There's so many components. But if you still not comfortable reading the Audible, we have a gentleman by the name of Robert Graham who did some Budweiser commercials. He actually reads the book and it does it very entertainingly. So if they just pop it on your phone or your car or whatever, and you can listen to the Audible as well. It hit number one on 13 categories on Amazon. Came out October
Yeah.
3rd, and we're just a paperback is coming out in 2 months from now. So we're looking forward to that.
Right on, man. So on Amazon, dude. Yeah, thank you so much, man. And I highly recommend the book, dude. And you can tell you know what you're talking about just by the success that you've faced with your companies. So yeah, huge props, Amazon, for the book. And yeah, Colin Campbell, man, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
A pleasure, man.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that podcast episode. And if you want to get a free copy of my book, go to kylesbook.com and you can get a copy there. I'll talk with you soon.